Call the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services to order on February 11, 2008. And I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 1093. This is a bill that we brought back thinking we were going to amend it. We had amendments, but they aren't going to work. So we're going to pass it just like it was before. But I think Senator Gordley had asked a question about contracting on this bill, and we'd like to have Barney Spate come up and explain that piece to her and all of us.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Barney Spate, the director of the Oregon Health Fund Board. Let me describe to you the problem that I confronted when I returned to Oregon to help set up the board. Is that Senate Bill 329, section, I believe it's section 7 of the original bill, provided that the board was exempt from most public contracting statutes, with the exception of disposal of unused property. I was not in the state or in the capital when 329 was developed, but did ask leaders, legislative leaders, and members of the executive branch the purpose of Section 7. And its purpose, as I understand it, and the basis on which I was managing the work of the board, was that given the very short time that the board had when the bill was passed, basically 14 months to develop a comprehensive plan, and the understanding that there would be some requirement to get consultative services, particularly in the area of microsimulation and other kinds of actuarial experience advice for the board and for the staff, is that they were providing this flexibility so that the board and its staff could move quickly in the process of getting the work done by October 1 of 2008. Subsequently, as I was moving through the management approaches, I was informed by the Assistant Attorney General who advises the board that the way the section Senate Bill 329 was constructed, that the public contracting exemptions provided in Section 7 did not apply to us because of the way the funds were appropriated. We are embedded, if you will, inside of DHS, and therefore we would have to abide by the contracting approaches of DHS. The purpose of the amendments that were offered requested by me, was to give the board the flexibility through this biennium to be able to pursue its work as was originally envisioned. That's the background that I have.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, and good morning.
Good morning,
Mr. Spate. And again, I just wanted to make sure that we established for the record what was the intent around the exemption in the bill. What I'm hearing, again, I want to make sure I'm hearing you, is that you must abide by the standards that DHS follows.
Under the current interpretation of 329, without the amendments in Senate Bill 1093, we would not, the provisions of Section 7 of 329 would not apply, so we are, if you will, embedded in the public contracting approaches of DHS.
So that means there would be no exemptions?
Correct.
To the public contracting requirements.
Correct.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to establish for the record. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
for
ma'am.
Taking time.
Thank you, Mrs. Bink. Glad to have you back.
Nice to be back, Madam Chair.
I would like to entertain then a motion for the Dash 1 amendments. We've already passed this.
Madam Chair, I move LC Dash 1 amendments dated 2508 to Senate Bill 1093.
Senator Gorley moves LC 1 amendments dated 2508 to Senate Bill 1093. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1093 to the floor with a due pass as amended, and the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Gordy moves Senate Bill 1093 to the floor with a due pass as amended, and the bill will be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter.
Excused.
Senator Curry. Aye.
Senator Dorsey?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gordon?
Aye.
Senator Marshall?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senate Bill 1093 is declared passed. With that, I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 1075. Sandy, would you bring us up to date on where we are on that one? And
thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1095, as you recall, creates a 24-member task force on mental
Excuse
health.
Excuse me, 1075.
Excuse me, 1075. Did I say 1095? I apologize, Member Cruz and audience and members of the committee. 1075 creates a 24-member task force on mental health and addiction services for underserved populations, declares an emergency effective on passage. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. You have a hand engrossed of the dash ones. This increases the task force membership from 24 to 25, and it specifies that that additional person be a person from the Department of Corrections who provides treatment and services for persons with mental illness. You also have in your packet a revised fiscal impact statement. You will notice we did have a first one, but they were able to get us a revised with the amendments early this morning. It highlights that it was based, that they revised it also based on information from the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair,
discussion.
What I would like to do is, with your permission, call up Patty O'Sullivan and whoever else you would like to bring with her to establish for the record that the Department of Human Services, through Mr. Bob Nickel, the Director of Mental Health and Addiction Services, to establish that the department is able to do the work called for in Senate Bill 1075 by absorbing the cost within their current budget. I'd like to establish that for the record, and also establish that Mr. Nickel contacted me directly by email on February 7th, 2008. You all have a copy of that email communication from Mr. Nickel in front of you, I believe. Again, establishing that once the bill is passed, the cost would be absorbed within the DHS budget. So I'm asking that Ms. O'Sullivan, and I'm sorry, I forget your name. My apologies.
Senator Gordley, it's Andy Smith.
Andy Smith, thank you. Again, establish and clarify for the record how we move forward.
For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm the Director of Public Policy and Government Relations for the Department of Human Services. And Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Gordley, you are correct. When we look at fiscal impacts of this sort for a task force, if it's a brand new subject to do a task force on and we're not currently doing any work on that, we many times will have a half FTE or three quarters of an FTE depending on the scope of the task force's work. In this particular case, we're doing a lot of the work around the department, although it's not very coordinated, which I think you heard in testimony. And Dr. Goldberg and Bob Nickel both recognize and support this bill. And we have the Office of Multicultural Health in Portland who will be assigned this bill. And in addition, we have a position out at Oregon State Hospital that works on cultural competency. We have a lot of work in seniors that's going to be occurring over the biennia. And so what we see this task force doing is pulling all that together, current work that's going on, and to focus and really direct the work of many into a consolidated report back to you on underserved populations in the addictions and mental health arena. So we don't see this as being new. We see this as being a coordinated effort, and what we will do is redirect a part of a clerical person and another staff, plus all these other people wrapping around it to support the task force and get the work done within our budget.
Clarification. So there still will be a fiscal impact.
Chair Monis Anderson, our fiscal impact to LFO mentioned this coordinating factor and that we would not need an FTE. We had a very small amount of money. I think it was $17,000 or $18,000, which is just to pay any costs and office supplies and all those kinds of things. We would be able to absorb that into.
So the fiscal impact statement we have is incorrect.
The fiscal impact statement you have, Chair, is from LFO. And we give ours to them, and then they develop it, and they saw it a little bit differently than we did. And by all rights, I mean, in their mind, we just have somebody sitting around waiting to do this, and if we do, then we shouldn't have that position, and that's not really the case. So, you know, they look at it as if you can, how many things can we absorb? And when they're done, then what do those people do? Well, I can assure you there's plenty to do, and we will be redirecting people, which does mean that something else won't get done. But, you know, we prioritize within the department every day.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
What we are prioritizing through this measure is a focus on underserved populations. And I think that, you know, what we're basically hearing this morning is that The fiscal statement can be disregarded because we have an understanding with the department that they will absorb costs. That's very clear in my mind. We're asking the department to, and this is just stating further, that we're asking the department to establish, through the work of the task force, best practices for underserved populations. And it just makes no sense in my mind that as a state we could go forward with service or looking at mental health services and the delivery of those services to all Oregonians without having some work go forward around this focus. So I hope that we're clear now on where we are and that we're clear that this is a bill, this is a measure that can move forward this morning.
Senator Morissette?
I was just going to whisper in her ear that when she moves this bill, she move it to the floor rather than to the Ways and Means Committee.
It has, as you know, the fiscal statement does, I mean, the bill has a referral to Ways and Means. If you read the fiscal statement in the second to the last paragraph, LFO would point out that these resources could apparently be used for other budgetary purposes, including modest amounts of general fund savings if this measure is not adopted. That statement indicates to me that you will be taking money from somewhere else and be using it for here, the 18,000. Something else will not be done. That was the statement that you said. So that's why in getting direction too from the president's office that it will be very difficult for the Ways and Means to be rescinded by the president's office.
That makes no sense to me, Madam Chair. And, you know, I don't want to be difficult this morning, but I do want to be clear. Because we have a department director, Bob Nickel, director of mental health and addiction services, who has said for the record, and we have a statement in front of us, that these are costs that can be absorbed. And in a phone conversation I had with him, he was very apologetic that this matter had even come up in this form, and he talked about the Office of Multicultural Health as a place where this work could be placed, and he had some other ideas about how the work could be accommodated. So I don't want to see this get caught in some silly red tape that thwarts our moving forward with important public policy to serve underserved populations. We need to be flexible on this committee, and we need to advocate on behalf of those populations who are not being adequately served today. And so let's find our way to send a message to the president's office that that's what we need, is some flexibility, let's get rid of the Ways and Means referral and get on with it.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I would agree, and I would suggest that when the motion's made, the motion includes a request to rescind the subsequent referral, and I mean, the president is going to do what the president's going to do, but at least the case can be made at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I
can cruise it. Yes?
I can't support that. Because if the bill has a referral, if there's money engaged in it, I think it does need to go away from the bill.
Senator Carter, unfortunately, you were out of the room when we had the discussion clarifying that these are costs that can be absorbed by the department, and the department has made clear that these are costs that can be absorbed. And there's a statement, a memo in front of you.
Point well taken.
Okay.
And unfortunately, we need to give then this information back to LFO. I think that LFO was given that information, correct? Sandy, have they had this information that the revised?
I believe they. I don't know. I know they saw the original because I did share that with them. Have you seen the revised since it came out this morning?
Chair Mona Sanderson, sure. What we sent to LFO had a minimal $18,000 fiscal impact just for office supplies and all that. And then we have a narrative, and in the narrative we discussed how we intend to carry out what's in the bill. And in that we put together three little bits and said this is about what it would take. What you're looking at is LFO's fiscal impact. They take ours, analyze it, and then they do theirs. And so you're looking at theirs. That is not what ours looked like going over.
Mm-hmm. That's what I want to clarify. So they still look at it as it will take take resources away from something else, but they're willing to take money from somewhere else. And LFO interprets it differently, that it will still cost this amount. And something else will not be done, and that is a Ways and Means issue. So,
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just to put Mr. Nichols' words on the record, he says in his email, again, which committee members have in front of you, "I'm sorry that the question even came up. I think we were just trying to show our estimate of the impact on FTE, but there was no intent to slow the bill down, or certainly not to stop it. Once we will definitely work with your bill once it's passed and absorb the cost within our budget." I don't think we can get any clearer than that.
And I guess I'm not worried that this will not get through Ways and Means. I think because it died in Ways and Means last time, we have a Ways and Means process, and we cannot, I feel, when our LFO comes out with a fiscal statement based on what the department gave, they state that it will need a referral to Ways and Means. And when we have such strong advocates, you as well as Senator Carter, on the Ways and Means, I think that the outcome will be different. I know, I hear what you're saying, and I don't... I think that we can make a motion to the president to rescind the referral. I don't have a problem with that. I think that we need to realize that that may not happen. But then again, I can't speak for the president that it could happen.
I think Senator Cruz would like to make a motion.
I'm sure I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1075.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 1075. Is there any discussion?
Discussion.
Yes.
Madam Chair, what were your last comments that you were about to make?
That we could make a motion to rescind the referral. To rescind the referral to Ways and Means. And then the president would make that decision.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1075 to the floor with a do pass recommendation as amended and request that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded by the President.
Senator Cruz moves that Senate Bill 1075 as amended be passed to the floor with a request to the President to rescind the referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Yes,
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. I fully support this, and I don't want in any way for this statement to be construed as minimizing the ethnic barriers that people face in this state. But clearly, in my mind, the biggest barrier to health care is income, and the underserved population in the state of Oregon are poor people. Of all ethnicities. So hopefully that is addressed by the task force as well as the very valid other barriers that exist. But big picture, our people in our state that have serious mental health issues tend to be our poor people, and they're the ones that are not getting the services.
And I would also state that it is extremely frustrating to have such a short one-month session where we only have three meetings to, I think, pass extremely important legislation. And I know there was an amendment from AFSCME and SEIU that they wanted to put two of their members on this task force, which I fully support, and unfortunately we don't have, because this has to pass out today, that we are not able to do that. With that, Senator Gordley, do you have any comments?
I really appreciate Senator Cruz speaking to the issue of low-income Oregonians, and it would be my request, Madam Chair, that Senator Cruz carry the bill on the Senate floor. And as a part of your floor statement, if you would make those comments.
Be happy to.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion on this bill? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morrison?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gordon?
Aye.
And Chair Monica
Anderson? Aye. Motion passed, and
the bill ends up where it is.
And yes. Senator Cruz will carry the bill. And thank you, Senator Gordley, for bringing this forward.
Certainly. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, for your patience this morning.
With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1075, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1089. And this should be, I think, a little bit more straightforward. We have the dash twos that we will be looking at, and basically it just clarifies that the Department of Human Services will contract out, and it will use existing reports that are done, already done. The Judicial Department has been added. We'll be using Medicaid and non-Medicaid community health services. They will be using Medicaid and non-Medicaid. They're going to look at the unreimbursed services in the assessment, and it will also require the report for them to report back to us, this committee, in October during the interim. And they are going to be using the alcohol and drug assessment that's going on right now, as well as the kids wraparound assessment. So that's what everyone's happy with the amendment, and any discussion? Do you need anyone to come forward?
Can you get that through?
All right. I would like to have someone consider the motion.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Move that Senate Bill 1089 be moved to the committee.
We need an amendment.
Move the amendment.
Dash two
amendment to Senate Bill 1089.
Senator Carter moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1089. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Move Senate Bill 1089 to the floor. Does it have a referral?
Yes.
To the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Carter moves 1089. 89 to the floor with a due pass with a referral to Ways and Means.
Due pass as amended.
Oh, as amended. Is there any discussion?
Clerk will call. Due pass as amended.
Due pass as amended. I think we got all those
yes.
words.
All right.
In. Okay. With the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Yes.
All right.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator
Cruz? Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gordy?
Aye.
Chair
Aye. Motion passes. And I will now close this work session on Senate Bill 1089, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 1100. And unfortunately, there were a number of people, and we needed a number of amendments, and the only amendment that came through is the work group amendment, and Senator Atkinson is not here. There was such not opposition to the concept of telehealth, but more that there are different factions here that view telehealth in a little bit different manner. We have the hospitals, we have the physicians, we have the carriers, the large carriers as well as the small carriers. And so that was why I talked with Senator Atkins and say, let's just do a work group through this committee and get it then ready for the 09 session. And he agreed, but then I got a voicemail, and I haven't talked to him since, saying, oh, I want it passed as is. So, unfortunately, he's not here. It would have to go to Ways and Means. Anyway, I would prefer that I not go to Ways and Means because I'm so afraid that it will die unless we amend it. It still will have to go to Ways and Means, but if we had the amendment, at least we had a better chance of it not dying. So, clarifications or comments?
Well,
Senator Morissette.
I really like the concept, but I know it has to be amended, and I know we have to have a work group. And so if it goes to Ways and Means and it dies in Ways and Means, you will still have an opportunity to work the bill.
Yeah,
it's going to go to Ways and Means either way, right?
With yes.
or without the amendment.
It could go to Ways and Means, and I'm committed to having a work group even if we don't do the amendment.
Yeah.
So it's sort of up to the committee what they want to do.
Madam Chair, yes. Is Senator Atkinson unavailable for this work session?
I do not know.
Okay.
Do you have a comment on that?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess it was my understanding from leadership that, for example, you could not refer bills to other committees just to keep them alive, nor were they going to be doing a lot of substantive work in Ways and Means, so because they don't have the time for that either. So I'm not sure at this point moving it to Ways and Means takes it anywhere, because obviously there's some substantive work still to be done.
Senator Atkins really wanted a bill, and I thought the way to keep it was to be able to, that would pass, that having a work group would keep it alive, and that's why I proposed, what amendments are they, the dash ones. But,
do we have another bill to hear?
No, this is the last
okay,
one.
We're
and so,
to see where,
let's. We could recess it
you can.
Until we can find out where Senator Atkinson is in, and we can start our informational hearing. Okay. So let's just close the work session on Senate Bill 1100, and let's go on until Senator Atkinson comes. And we'll start our informational meeting, and then Brian Johnson. Yeah. Just understand that we may have to interrupt you. So with that, the Senate Bill 1100 is closed, work session is closed, and colleagues, we had a report a scathing report, I think, again, on our child welfare system. And I have asked Brian Johnson, the interim assistant director of DHS, to go over that report with us. And we'll be doing some follow-up on Wednesday. Remember the report on psychiatric medications left being used in the foster care system. We'll be dealing with that directly. And if we have to go further with our informational hearing on the child welfare system, we certainly will do that. Okay, with that, I would like to open an informational hearing on child and family services, on the family and child services review. And thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Johnston. I'm the assistant director at DHS in charge of, amongst other things, the CAF division. With me today is Kathy Ledesma, who is the assistant administrator in the Office of Program Performance and Reporting. What I'm about to do is to give you a summary of the report, and by way of a preface, I don't want anything that I say this morning to be taken in a defensive light or to be taken as an excuse. The reality is that the evaluations were not good, we have much work to do, and we intend to do it. But I do want you to have the background and some understanding of the report. This is the second time that we've had a CSFR report. The first one was in 2001. A evaluation like this results in what's called a program improvement plan and some negotiation with the federal government in terms of how much you will improve. Our 2001 report resulted in that program improvement plan. And we revisited in 2004, and at that time they passed us and said that we had made the necessary improvement pursuant to the 2001 investigation. In 2007, we revisited again in the summer, and each time they come, they take 65 cases from a jurisdiction and evaluate those 65 cases, and they evaluate them on a variety of measures. They had made some changes in the 2007 report. One of the changes was that in order to be in compliance with the standard, that measure had gone from 90% of your cases in compliance to 95%. Another one of the changes was that in the 2001 report, most frequently, contact with a parent was sufficient to meet the standard. In the 2007, it meant contact with both parents, and in some instances, it also meant both parents and age-appropriate children. So it expanded the number of people you had to contact, and it expanded the number of folks you had to involve in visits, that sort of thing. The net effect is that we fell dramatically from 2001 to 2007. In none of the seven outcomes, and each of the outcomes has then sub-items that go to the outcome, in none of the seven items were we in substantial conformance. And in amongst the 21 separate items that relate to those seven outcomes, well, we had three that were listed as strengths, and 21. Of the 23, we had three that were listed as strengths and 20 that were listed as improvements necessary. I'm going to ask Kathy Ledesma if she would walk you through the handouts, and we'll take any questions that you might want to discuss.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma from the Department of Human Services. I gave you two of three things we brought along with us, and be glad to share the third in a moment if you'd like to see it. First of all, it's the executive summary. The entire Child and Family Services Review report is about 118 pages, so we spared you that reading pleasure and condensed down on the final four pages of that document are the scores, are essentially the report cards. ANI means area needing improvement. As you just cast your eyes down the page, heavy area needing improvement in 20 out of the 23 items, as Brian has stated. Even though there were three items that we passed, our performance in those three items was not strong enough to bring us up into a substantial conformity realm on the corresponding outcome. performance, there were three sites visited. There were 17 cases read in Deschutes County, 17 in Multnomah County, and 31 in, 17 in Deschutes, 17 in Marion, and 31 in Multnomah County. So it's a very small sampling that the feds do when they come and read cases, but they're reading for quality. They then substantiate what they read in the cases with interviews of stakeholders, everyone from the child who is the subject of the case, the parents, the foster parents, the judge, the Citizen Review Board, the child's CASA, the child's attorney, and then state-level stakeholders as well that would be judges and others who are involved in the child welfare system. And then the third part is of the review is a look at the data that we actually submit twice a year to the federal government electronically that looks at the same sorts of things that they look at in the qualitative reviews of the cases and where those things agree, the interviews agree with the case readings, agree with the data that we submit, then we get a strength or an area needing improvement or a pass or a not in substantial conformity on the corresponding outcomes. Where we go from here is we have been working with the Federal Regional Office even in advance of actually receiving our report from them to talk about how we might go about improving our system. We believe that one of the things that happened between the two things that happened between 2004 when we concluded successfully our program improvement plan and when we were reviewed again last year, those two things that happened are there was a net loss in the kinds of services that are available to families involved in the child welfare system across the board. And we've taken a look at that. We've talked with Governor about that. We've talked internally in the department about that. The $10 million that has recently become available is just exactly the kind of money that we need targeted so that parents can get the kinds of services that they need to regain custody of their children sooner or to otherwise resolve the case. The second thing that happened in the years that intervened is that once we took the focus off of the outcomes, once we had achieved those areas needing improvement, our attention really turned to other things. And it, however, it came as no surprise that we didn't do well in this review.
Hey, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd point out two more practical things, if I may. Give you an illustration. I think what's amongst the things that are happening, and there's no doubt many, but amongst them is some prioritization that goes on in a caseworker's day-to-day life. For example, in one of the issues that measures for safety is how quickly do we respond? And if there is an emergency, all responses are lumped together for the evaluation, and we fail to meet substantial conformity. If you read the entire report, it said, if there's an emergency, Oregon does well. Goes out, gets there quickly, evaluates the situation. Where we failed to meet the standard was there are some things that you're given up to 5 days to respond. For example, an anonymous phone call comes in. It says, Judy's mom and dad are doing drugs. In that situation, it's an anonymous tip. There's been no law enforcement involvement. We're supposed to respond within 5 days, and the caseworkers don't get there as often as they should within 5 days. If someone comes in and says, a law enforcement person says, we've arrested Judy, we're there at that same time. We frequently go with law enforcement when they're serving search warrants and things, because if children are involved, we take the children immediately. So Oregon is good for an emergency situation, but doesn't have enough people, doesn't do the work in ways that allow it to meet all the other needs. I'll give you one more example of that, and then I'll stop and take any questions you might have. The other example I was going to talk about was visits. How many times a caseworker actually goes to the home to check, not a scheduled visit with the child, but to check on a random basis and to check in. Well, the same thing happens. If you've got 30 and 40 cases, you prioritize those visits where you think your presence would be most appropriate. In other words, if you've got a child who's doing well, there's been no subsequent reports, everything looks good in his or her home, we aren't getting there within 30 days. We should be. That's what the standard is, to visit within 30 days. If you've got a child who you think there's a scintilla of risk, Oregon gets there. We check that child out two or three times within that 30 days. But we're not doing the ones that are, you know, less pressing. So what it is ordinary people prioritizing their work.
This might be a good chance. Senator Atkinson has come in. But what I really would like you to do when you come back was to actually go through, to get on record, where we failed. And it starts on page 3. And I really would like you to go through, not necessarily line item by line item, but pretty much all of the areas where we were deficient.
Madam Chair, members of the committees, I will certainly come back and indicate where we failed to meet federal compliance.
Can I give some questions?
Yes, go ahead, Senator Carter.
I'd like to know, between 2004, what was the number of caseworkers that you had? And number of caseworkers as of last session? Philosophical changes between 04 and 07, and the ratio of caseworker to clients, to numbers of children they have in their charge.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, we'll try and get that information for you in this brief interlude.
Thank you.
Okay.
And if you need to talk to me because you didn't get some of Malcolm down, you give me some.
No, I got it. Okay. Thank you so much.
With that, I'll close the informational hearing, but we will be, close the informational hearing, and I'd like to reopen a work session on Senate Bill 1100, and Senator Atkinson, please come forward, and we'll let you know where we're at. At this point, the bill will go to Ways and Means. We've asked for amendments, and the only amendment that came forward was the work group that we had talked about earlier, and that you had first said yes, and then you said no, you didn't want the work group. Now today I want to know, should we go ahead with the work group or just send it will have to go to Ways and Means as is, and it's your preference, and I was hoping to at least have something come out of this for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jason Atkinson, representing Southern Oregon. As we spoke, and I do appreciate the deference that you're providing to me, I don't support a work group. We did this last session. The people who were opposed to it then and opposed to it now knew that I'm still working on it. They've been having their own whatevers, but they didn't come to this session ready to go. I believe that a work group will prove the following things. Number one, when we wrote the bill, we followed Medicaid. Number two, we drew it narrowly down so that it could be opted in. Number three, that it was laid out for rural communities who are going to suffer when the federal funding doesn't come in and the first program that gets cut is services to people with mental needs. And so the time isn't to a work group is going to make sure a bunch of professional folks have a meeting to go to, but my push was to have something done by this summer that is actually tangibly going to help Oregonians. And a work group doesn't quite do that. I'm sure they'll meet and perhaps even be demonized for speaking against a work group, but that's tough. The real thing is actually trying to help people now. A bill that should have passed last session, a bill that was fully vetted on both sides, on all three sides of the aisle. We have one of the nation's leading experts, Dr. Knight Richardson, and we are not utilizing him and his expertise that's being pioneered at Oregon Health Science University. That is a tragedy of access to health care for us. Not one of the people who came up in opposition to this bill spoke to me before session started. Not one of the people who came up in opposition to the bill spoke about how many people their idea was going to help. In fact, people were secondary to insurance concerns. And if you recall, the biggest concerns were raising costs that Dr. Knight Richardson and I answered every point that this was not going to increase costs. And yet when the opposition was asked to speak and they said, why, how are people, as Senator Avell Gordley asked, how are people going to get coverage while the work group meets, they said, go to the emergency room. I'm sorry, but that is unacceptable. And for that reason, I don't want a work group.
Okay, and just to clarify a couple of things, the language in the bill, DHS rules are different than DCBS's rules. And so the language would need to change, and that came up in the last meeting, but we don't have amendment today that deals with that issue. There just needs to be a brief wording change. Maybe we can request that in ways and means. But the other is there are 18 counties that this would be that would affect. And if there was just a 1% increase in utilization rate, and this is for our Medicaid clients, it would be an impact, fiscal impact of $925,000. It's not stated here in our fiscal because, well, it's not stated in the fiscal that we got, but this would, that's why this bill is going to need to go to Ways and Means, because when they say the fiscal is indeterminate is because we do not yet know the utilization rate for telemedicine for reimbursement rates, how that would affect the county. So it will still need to go to Ways and Means, and that's what I wanted to let you know, because even if there was a utilization of 1%, it still would have almost $1 million impact.
Well, I just think that that's tragic. This morning we just voted on a bill that last session had, I think, five times higher fiscal impact than it did this morning. The fear around this bill and the concerns from the professional people who are involved in this. Let me just remind you. At our Oregon Health Science University, we are helping people in Katrina victims receive this care at no cost. At no cost. Why in the world are we not allowing it to be used in Douglas County, in Jackson County, in Josephine County, in Curry County, in Wheeler County, in Coos County? Because people have concerns, because it's indeterminate. You know, at a certain point, you have to say, perhaps we need to lead, which I appreciate, Madam Chair. But, you know, if we have to go fight this out in Ways and Means, perhaps this committee will help me do that and tell that story. So, with that, I close my comments.
All right. Thank you so much.
Question.
Thank you.
Yes.
So, DHS, has DHS put that on record, how much that was on?
DHS did not know about this bill until when we did, the beginning of the week, last week. So DCBS and DHS weren't aware of 1,100 coming forward in the format. So they saw it then, and they came, they gave some testimony, and Jim Edge is willing to work on this, and they let me know the changes that would need to happen. And they also let us know that the reason the fiscal is indeterminate is because they don't know how much utilization will happen for our Medicaid patients in rural areas.
Madam Chair, Senator, I would be willing to work with you and Jim Edge of DHS for us to take a look at this, because I think it doesn't make sense at all that we can do something between here and Louisiana and there's no cost, and we can't do it in Douglas County with no cost. I have a problem with that, too. So I'd be willing to work with you and Jim Edge on this issue.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, thank you very much. My conversations with them in the hall were, we can do this. The problem we have here is a political problem. It's not an actual get it done problem.
If
this is enabling. Yeah. This is an option.
Edge back in?
Yes, Mr. Edge, would you please come up?
you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Edge. I'm the administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services.
Ms. Edge, can you tell me that if, back to using the chair's data, if there's a 1% change in the way we do business in terms of this telemedicine, that it would cost you nearly $1 million to do that?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, we initially put an indeterminate price on this bill because we just weren't sure. We went back after Friday's hearing and tried to do a more concrete price on this. We looked at the fact that it probably would take one staff person to administer a telemedicine program in DHS, and so we put that into the fiscal analysis. We put in the narrative of the fiscal that we really have a difficult time knowing what the utilization change would be. But if we look at the underserved parts of the state and estimate a 1% increase in utilization, which is very small, that amounts to a $925,000 increase in expenditures, which is very small in terms of our overall budget. But that would be the impact of a 1% increase in utilization. We also had a conversation with DCBS and talked about the rulemaking issue that came up and felt that just a one-word change in the bill would resolve that. If we changed the word consistent with to in consultation with, that would resolve the fact that DCBS rules and DHS rules are two different kinds of rules.
All right. Any other questions? I would like to know the wishes of the committee. Do I hear a motion?
Mm-hmm. One more thing. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if we had opportunities for this bill to go one more day to give the senator the opportunity to work with Ways and Means to do this. Because I don't want this bill to fail. It's a pretty progressive bill, and mm-hmm. it gives opportunity to rural people and to low-income people. And I'd like to know what the senator's pleasure would be that you hold it here rather than just to pass it to the floor, or what, I don't know the dynamics of rulemaking that would allow it to go to the floor or stay here with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, or the senator have a chance to work it out before he gets there.
Yeah, let's just stand at ease just for a few seconds. Okay. To see if we could, at the request of Senator Carter, whether we could move that. And the administrator was letting us know that scheduling of rooms is extremely problematic, and we would need to give a 24-hour notice, which would need to go into effect. That would be nothing.
Space.
And we could have then a meeting tomorrow evening. Yes. Senator Carter or Gordley.
Is the Senate chamber considered a space? Madam Chair, members of the committee, public are not allowed on the Senate floor. So we would be in violation of our rules of making our meetings available to the public.
Senator Morrison.
What's the Ways and Means schedule?
Every afternoon, 3:30.
Pardon me?
Every afternoon, 3:30.
If this bill were referred, would you deal with it in a timely manner?
I think that with Senator Gordley and I both on that mm-hmm. committee, that it could happen.
Because the issue is not whether or not, I don't think necessarily goes to Ways and Means, it's whether or not it's going to come out of Ways and Means. And that would
exactly.
be...
Well, it's going to go.
Well, it's going to go, right. But no I mean, what. Rather yeah. than try to... keep it an extra day, which is going to pose a problem in precedent for other things. If it were to go and then come out, I think that's the important thing, is that it come out of Ways and Means and that we move
What's
along.
The bill number?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
1100.
I move that Senate Bill 1100 is sent to Ways and Means Committee.
Okay.
With a recommendation.
With a due pass.
With a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Carter moves Senate Bill 1100 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Yes, Senator.
Well, I just think that let the record show that we or I encourage Ways and Means to consider the bill and pass it to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation in a timely manner. I think that's the purpose.
Yes. Yeah, that would be. Yes, Senator Gordley.
And the other message for Ways and Means is to we need to capture what we heard from Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson and from Senator Atkinson about the urgency, that sense of urgency about the needs in the counties that are going to be hard hit by the loss of federal funds. And it appears to me that what we have in this session is an opportunity to look at, you know, what is the package of resources, financial and otherwise, that we need to get together for those counties that we know are going to be hard hit, not just in terms of serving the medically underserved population in these rural counties, but what are some of the other needs, and what is the package that we're going to put together that addresses those counties, those affected counties in this session?
Yeah.
And I'm not aware that if that discussion is going on someplace in the building in a coordinated fashion and in a way that says this will be the package that we deliver for those rural counties, I'm just unaware of it.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. Well, I'm going to take this poor gentleman here, walk him down, and get an amendment drafted just for that one word.
Okay.
I'm also going to do following. I'm also going to write an amendment that calls it a pilot program for four counties and knock that fiscal down to nothing. If it kills me, someone will die.
I think that's a good.
But I'll knock it down to nothing. And then when it goes to Ways and Means, we can tell them this. And if we can get it passed Ways and Means and we can amend it in the House or whatever we need to do,
it'd for time. The amendments happen here or in Ways and Means. That won't
fine.
Go to the House.
That's fine. Screw you. Then at least Oregon Health Sciences and DHS are going to spend the next 10 months getting the program going and making sure that no one falls through the cracks before we take it statewide. That's fine with me. I just don't want to. My worry is that if we don't do something, we're going to let a work group meet, and then we're going to get here in January, and then there's going to be an emergency clause, and then we're not going to have anything done to even start getting ready for until July of 2009 or January of 2010. Here's the other little part in it. Over the weekend, I was doing my work, and I called the head of USDA, and I said, I might need a grant to buy any equipment I might need for rural hospitals. Can we do that? Done. Not an issue. Money's not the issue. All we need is enabling language.
I just sent Sandy out to see so that we can deal with. I don't want to get mucked up in Ways and Means with the other amendment that you're proposing. That the one word change could happen in Ways and Means, but your other amendment to get a targeted area.
Uh-huh.
Would take an amendment that would need to go through this committee.
Okay.
And so I've asked Sandy to find out where there is a room tomorrow afternoon that we could meet with those amendments. So would you want to rescind your motion?
Madam Chair, I rescind my motion to send Senate Bill 1100 to the Ways and Means Committee for the examination of our role here in this committee.
Any concerns about that amendment?
Madam, so
ordered.
Madam Chair, may I make a...
Yes.
Could I get these amendments drafted right now? Could you come back today?
That's what we're going to do. She's looking to see if we can get a time today. So
may I be dismissed and go to...
Yes, exactly. Exactly. All right. With that, I here comes Sandy before I close the and see what she says.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we could get C, hearing room C at 5, A or B at 5:30, F at 5:30. I don't know what your schedules are, though, sir.
Tomorrow.
You have tomorrow, Tuesday.
5:30 works best for me.
Today.
I would just...
Tomorrow or today?
Until 5:30.
I looked at tomorrow.
Okay.
But I don't know if... I don't know what our deadline is. Is it 5?
It's 5.
It's 5.
It's 5.
I was hoping we could do it today.
5.
Oh. Okay.
If he can get the amendments. Tomorrow would be more realistic, but if the cutoff is at 5.
Are you sure about that?
There's a couple of things administratively that I would have to get clarification. Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you want to do it today, later on today, you would need to stand in recess because we're under our posting. If you want to do it tomorrow, so I'm not sure how you want me to.
We'll probably recess until 5:30 tonight, and then hopefully three of us will be here at 5:30 tonight to either go forth with your amendments or...
And that was the other thing that I looked at on the schedule for a noon tomorrow, but I don't... Oh, okay. Because technically it won't take very long.
No, it wouldn't take long if we could get it. We could do it if you wanted to come in at 7:30 in the morning.
Why don't you
miss our 24-hour posting.
Allow me to see how quick they can draft this.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I suggest you stand in recess for now, see how things progress if you have to.
And then we'll coordinate. That's what we'll do. Okay, go forth and do good. With that, I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 1100, and I'm going to reopen the informational hearing on the Child and Family Services Review. Mr. Johnston?
Yeah.
Thank you for your indulgence. But, you know, again, I'm going to reiterate, having a one-month session just doesn't cut the mustard in my... in my world.
I would agree with you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, there are many things that I'm feeling free to comment on. That is not one of them.
I've always been shy.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, if you'll recall, Senator Carter asked us a couple questions at the end, and Vice Chair Gordley gave us some written questions, and if with the chair's permission, I'd like to try and respond to those. Senator Carter asked about the numbers of kind of a staffing history, and I have to plead ignorance. I've been with the department in this capacity since November 19th, and I don't know. I can say we can get you those numbers. The numbers just came in through the miracle of electronic transmission. And I'm going to turn it over to the smarter half of this presentation.
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to say, yes. I thought they were coming back on Wednesday. I didn't mean to rush you today. Those questions.
Well, they may be if we can't get through everything in the hour.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Carter, and members of the committee, in response to your question.
Reintroduce yourself.
For the record, I'm Kathy Ledesma from the Department of Human Services. Senator Carter, if I transcribed your questions correctly here, in July of 2004, we had 1,056 caseworkers. And as the end of when the 2007 session ended, as you know, positions were added, we had 1,193 and a half caseworkers. The caseload ratios in 2004, there was one caseworker for every 25 children. And in 2007, at the conclusion of the session, one caseworker for every 15 children, and those are children in foster care. Children in residential treatment, the ratio was 1 to 40 in 2004 and 1 to 15 in 2007. For in-home cases, 2004, 1 to 16. And I believe that is cases, not children.
Okay.
and in 2007, 1 to 17. I do want to double-check that, though, to make sure I'm correct about that.
Madam Chair, if I may, that one is the same caseworker.
Yes.
So you have to add those things up and come to, so in other words, one caseworker has so many people in foster care, so many people in different forms of residential care, et cetera. These are not separate categories of child protective workers. We only have one category of child protective worker. So their caseload is a combination of things.
Right.
You also asked Senator Carter about the change in philosophy. You might remember that in 2005, we had had two extraordinarily sad fatalities, and that led to a review of some of the work of the division and what was called the Holder Report. And the Holder Report was released in 2005 and led to, although it was not part of this study, what's called the Oregon Safety Model. And the Oregon Safety Model puts more onus on the caseworker to be decisive, to be speedy in the protection of the child, both a good thing and a complicating thing, because we are faulted for not adequately involving the parents and extended families and for not doing enough to allow children to remain in homes. And so we wind up with statistics like this. The national average for children removal is 4.1 per 100,000. In Oregon, that's almost doubled. It's almost 7.1 per 100,000. So we take out far more children per capita than do our sister states. And what we're trying to do is adjust the Oregon safety model, the reports that we've been given, making sure kids are safe, but give more services to people in homes. UPass, for example, Ms. Ledesma referenced the $10 million that came out of the 2007 session. That was sent to county mental health departments for the purpose of providing services, mental health and addiction services, as necessary to parents who are about to lose their children. This was that was the aim of it, so that we have a better chance of keeping those families together. We need to, if we're going to be successful long term, reduce the number of children that go into foster care. It's kind of ironic. I find myself having to give speeches elevating the need for people to step forward and provide foster care. At the same time, in my heart, I hope we don't put any more kids in foster care. So it's a mixed thing. If I may use your questions to transition to Senator Gordley's questions, we were asked about the worst-case scenario of Ways and Means. The worst-case scenario of Ways and Means is based upon some savings that were part of DHS's rebalance. And I have to explain this carefully because I do not envy where, especially Senators Carter and Gordley, you sit, because the projected savings in DHS's budget were built on the caseload model. In other words, our caseload had fallen, and the prediction was that therefore you save X number of dollars. But the savings are by reduction in staff in those arenas. Dr. Goldberg, the DHS director, asked the Ways and Means Committee not to take those savings because we at this time were having McKinsey take a look and do what was called a workload survey. Not a caseload, but a workload, trying to decide how much work you're supposed to do, not how many cases you have. Just to give you one small illustration, we're going to actually reveal that tomorrow in front of, I believe it's this committee, maybe it's another committee. I don't know. I can't keep track of all of you. One of the differences, for example, is if you're able to locate two parents, and you'll remember my earlier testimony where I said the federal government requires us to find the two parents, no matter, I hate to be sexist about this, but dad is generally gone. And so let's say that we can locate the paternal relative line and even the paternal. If you are successful in finding two parents on one case, you've just increased by 50% roughly the amount of work that has to go into that case. Because from that point forward, you're not just meeting with the maternal relatives, but you're having a separate meeting that's covering the same ground with the paternal relatives. And you might say, well, why don't you just bring them together? if they could stay together, we might not have been in this problem. So we don't get to bring them together.
So in this assessment that you're doing, because you have been focusing on case workers, and this brings in our health services assistants and
right.
their need. And so role, you're getting there.
I'm getting there, Chair.
Okay.
The bottom line is that the savings that were projected in the rebalance of DHS are ephemeral. They don't really exist, mm-hmm. in my mind.
Okay.
They exist on paper if you cut cases, but if you cut workers. If you cut workers, we will be saying to the federal government, you just failed us on 11 out of 14 standards, and so what we've decided to do is cut caseworkers. And you'll be saying to the kids of Oregon the same thing. That's why I say I certainly don't envy you, but that's where those savings are. They're in the application of a casework standard to a workload reality. And if you go by the workload, we need more people, not fewer. Now, as to SSAs, and to explain, SSAs are social service assistants. They are the people who drive children to meetings, who sometimes watch the visitation, who do all the things that allow the caseworkers' work to continue. They might take the kid to the doctor. They might take get a prescription that the child needs, that sort of thing. They do the things that we don't want caseworkers to do for ease of financial implication and for best use of the caseworkers' time. And they're very important. And what the deal that had been struck in the 07 session was that 107 new caseworkers would come on, very important, and the SSAs would be part of the mechanism for paying it. We would take what were called CETs, some educational people, and SSAs, and do away with their positions. Well, that was fine for a concept, but it didn't work in practice, because what we've done then is increase again this case workload for the caseworker and say, now you've got to drive this child. You've got to, and especially when we start talking in terms of rural Oregon, in terms of some of those distances. So at any rate, almost there were 78 of those SSAs altogether, and the net reality is that of those people who voluntarily transitioned out before the deadline when those positions would go away, we've had to replace every one of them so that the offices could keep functioning. And what we did was we decided that it would be foolish to have McKinsey study the caseworker without and what the caseworker does without the SSAs in place. Then we'd have a good picture. And if we had to come back to you and say, you know what, we have too many caseworkers, we'd know it. We'd say, and the SSAs were there, and we don't need that many caseworkers. That's not McKinsey's conclusion. It's quite the contrary. One of the other questions on Senator Gordley's sheet was, why didn't we study SSAs? We just studied caseworkers. And the answer to that is affirmative. We only studied caseworkers, but the SSAs were in place, so it's the same thing as saying, not that I'm not likening an SSA to a computer, but what you are studying is the function of the caseworker with all the assets and resources that he or she has at their control. One of the resources, of course, is the, you know, technology, and one of the resources is the office SSA or SSAs. So we studied them with the full panoply of resources that they had. And the conclusion that we will be sharing with the committee shortly is that we are understaffed for the caseload work that we've requested. And one final period to this sentence. One of the casework pieces that we request that weighs heavily on folks also came out of the 2007 session, and it was the encouragement to the Judicial Department to encourage visitation as a way of restoring and reuniting families. The good thing about that is all across the state, visitation is on the increase. The bad thing about it is it's being administered through the Judicial Department, which gives me 36 different plans to try and work with, because every county judiciary has its own right now. So if I had here, I would pull it off.
Madam Chair. Yes, Senator Carter.
When somebody get a bright idea again that is only on paper, such as looking at workloads, and thinking a computer in a labor-intensive community of operational ideas, philosophies, services, and that kind of stuff. Don't bring it. I mean, this is crazy as hell, I have to tell you that. How do we think that the computer can replace that face-to-face relationship that we have with children who are in serious trouble? I just don't understand that. I'm looking for you guys to take leadership on this, because I'm going to, you know what, you know that I'm a supporter of you guys, but I'm going to tell you, I will give you hell on this one if you come before us again with some mess like this. And I'm not killing the messengers, because I know you guys didn't do this, you were not there, but at the same time, when you look at all the work that we have undertaken since 2007 to try to give you the people that you need so you wouldn't come before us again, so our state would not be being, so the Oregonian would not have to write the kind of articles that they have written about what appears to be our lack or our insensitive to the needs of kids in our state. It makes my stomach turn. I have to tell you that. And I'd like to see, Mr. Johnson, you guys take a much more aggressive action in visiting the field. Because unless you visit the field, you are how many layers away from what is happening on the ground? I bet it's at least five. And you can't be accountable for something that you are that many layers away. You have to take the words of the people. I have to tell you, in the last 2 weeks, I've had three people that have come before me, that have come to me and said they want to file suit against the state for their negligence toward children in foster care and in other areas of child welfare. That doesn't bode well for somebody who is very supportive, and I'm you guys' worst enemy at times, you know, but it's only out of love of trying to make sure that we go forth together. And as chair of the committee who was there to give you guys what I thought you needed, I'm coming back saying, wait a minute, I can't sleep at night when I hear about State Hospital, when I hear about foster kids and over-medication and that kind of stuff. Something is wrong. We need to engage the people at the bottom a little more. See, it's one thing for you guys to come up here and testify before us, but it's another thing for those that are working in the field and working with our children every day to not be engaged in proper policy making, the consistency across the state in terms of what you expect from Multnomah County to Malheur County. Something is wrong here.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, thank you for your past support. I promise you allegiance that will earn your future support, and I came back to assist in the removal of that something which is wrong.
Any other comments?
Yeah,
sure. Yes, Senator Cruz.
I guess I'm not going to dispute anything Senator Carter said, but I mean, when you look at the difference in case rate from 4 to 7, the results haven't necessarily tracked it. Are we? Let me back up just a minute. Back years and years ago, when the feds came up with the concept of what the heck was that concept? Threat of harm. Mm-hmm. Okay, which nobody knew what it meant. Okay, maybe we still don't from their perspective. But what that, and we wrestled with it for a long time, and the feds have a tendency to do things like that on a relatively regular basis. And I guess I'm just wondering if there are bureaucratic, I mean, if there are some bureaucratic impediments here that are also making it more difficult. And I, with full understanding that the cases have gotten more difficult, the greater the use of meth and things like that in the families becomes, the more difficult the cases are. if there are some impediments that we could have direct impact on removing. And we talked about some of these things, but, you know, that threat of harm has stuck with me since the feds threw that on us, because we were making some pretty good progress at that point in time, and then they throw this monkey wrench in the middle of everything. So, because they thought it sounded good, I guess, but it didn't really match where we were going. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think there's two questions here. One question is the federal question, and one question here is the Oregon kid question.
Right.
And I care less about the former than the latter. The federal question, they're going to change their evaluation each time they do it. Personally, I would much prefer to be in conformance than not. I think it's appropriate that they continue to strive upward. They went from 90 to 95. Next time they can go to 98. It is important to note, not a single state has met these standards. Not a single state is in conformance. That's not by way of defense. That's by way of reality. But that's not the issue for me. It's not. I do want to clear the federal, because they'll penalize us if we don't. So I do want to clear it. But more importantly is we do want to do the things that we know are right for Oregon kids. And that's what our task is, and that's what we're supposed to be about.
All right. Proceed. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Carter, in answer to your question, the clarification that ratio for in-home cases is caseworker cases, okay. Not children.
Not children. Okay.
So I got that confirmation. So we're on page 17 of the executive summary that we provided for you. Let's take a quick look first at the way this page is laid out, this page and the page after it. There are 7 outcomes, 2 safety, 2 permanency, and 3 well-being. The bar on each one of those is, for the outcomes, is 95%, as Mr. Johnson has said. Each of those 7 outcomes has a variety of different number of associated items. The bar for those items is 90%, and that has not changed since the previous review. But for the outcomes, it has gone up to 95%. So for safety outcome 1, we're looking at essentially the prevention things. What are we doing to protect children in their homes or in their homes after we've seen them? So there are 2 items: how quickly we get out in response to or in relation to what our own rules are for timeliness of investigations. And then the second is the percentage of repeat maltreatment, meaning a second incidence of abuse or neglect within 12 months of the previous incident of abuse or neglect. So on that outcome, we were at 62.5%, which is a roll-up of the 2 items. And although it doesn't look like it corresponds, it really does correspond. For the timeliness of investigations, as Mr. Johnston said, we did wonderful on those immediate responses. It's the 5-day responses that would be things like Senator Cruz, the threat of harm, those sorts of things. And that's where we have the most opportunity for improvement. For repeat maltreatment, this is actually expressed the opposite way when you look at the federal measure, and that's the absence of repeat maltreatment. So we had this, the number that you see before you is not 87% repeat maltreatment. It is 87% absence of repeat maltreatment. Okay? And again, the bar is 90%.
So 13%. Tell me what maltreatment encompasses. What does that mean?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, maltreatment is abuse or neglect, and it is a substantiated report. So we've gone out, we've seen a child, the child has had a physical injury, and then within 12 months of that report, we get a second report that, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the same kind of maltreatment. So the first time it could be neglect, The second time it could be abuse.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I look at these things like 95%, and the feds are really good at putting a number out there that's statistically probably not achievable. Statistically. So I agree with you, Brian. I'm more interested in improvement than percentages. So, I mean, for what I need for me, I want to know the amount of improvement, not how we compare to some statistical anomaly. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, and members of the committee, we agree. We agree that no child should suffer a second incident of maltreatment.
Right.
That no child should. But are we in total control of that? Absolutely not.
They should suffer the first, but that's, you know.
Absolutely not. For each of these items, we will be negotiating with the regional office a level of improvement. And that's kind of a two-edged sword. If we negotiate low, then we've set the bar pretty low for what we want to achieve, but we avoid financial penalties because the penalty is calculated on of the goals that you negotiated, how many of those were you actually able to achieve over the two-year period of the program improvement plan. On the other hand, if we negotiate too high, then but we don't want any children to suffer repeat maltreatment, and we do want to be out and responsive as quickly as we should be. Okay. Madam Chair, moving on to safety outcome two, children are safely maintained in their homes when possible and appropriate. Achieved at 60%. Services to prevent removal. This is one of the many areas that we saw the impact of the reduction in services that were available to families. So that even if we've gotten out to a home very quickly and saw that, yes, there's a pervasive drug use going on here, the inability to get that parent who might be willing to go into drug treatment if they could be there, in many communities that's just not been readily available to them. Risk of harm is really taking a look at a lot of what the Oregon safety model does, and that's really equipping the caseworkers to go out and take a look at not only the what the allegation was, but what are all the risk factors that are present in a home. Permanency outcome two, these six items, really have to do with how quickly we move to identify an alternate permanency plan in case a return home or a leave at home plan fails. And so it's the establishment of the plan and then how quickly we achieve that plan. We did not do real well in that outcome overall. However, the performance across the items was varied. Foster care reentry, that means once we make a decision to send a child home, we're pretty sure that that child's going to be safe there and we don't have to take that child into care again. So that we did very, very well in that, exceeded the national standard. Stability of foster care placements, this is children moving from home to home within a system. There is a lot of concern about that. That has to do, again, with a resource issue. Do we have not only the number of foster parents, the number of foster homes, but do we have them geographically in the correct places? Do we have the kinds of homes that can respond to the cultural and physical and mental health needs of children, especially those children who have come from drug-impacted families and may have multiple problems. Big margin for improvement there. Mm-hmm. Establishment of the permanency goal, that just has to do with how quickly we say, okay, if return home fails, not only is adoption the best alternative for the child, but we have identified a resource for the child, an adoptive resource for the child, or other permanency outcome. We did fairly well in reunification, guardianship, and placement with relatives at 85%. On the other hand, we have the opposite end of the spectrum, and that's only 36% compliance with timeliness to adoption. I do want to say a word about the adoption measure this time. it's become very complex. That's one of the Fed's new composite measures, and it takes a look at subpopulations, so children who have been in care for more than 18 months, and it's a ratio of the number of children in care on the last day of the month divided by the number of children who have adoption plans that were not. It's very complex. And so it's not surprising that our performance really plummeted against this. On the other hand, we actually improved over the first time, even though our numbers were much higher the first time around. We actually had improved performance. We had more children getting to adoption in 24 months, and we have reduced the median length of time it takes to get children to adoption.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Thank you. How does that square with willingness to adopt? Do we have other... enough people who want to adopt that we can improve that if we can get through the red tape?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes and no. For some children, we have many resources. For young children, for white children, for single children, we have many resources, competing resources often, as you've heard. For other children, specifically for children over the age of 8 and children of color, and children who belong to sibling groups, and children who have very high mental health needs, we don't have enough homes, nor does any state have enough homes for those children.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would add 2 points to this. Number one, just to give you an illustration of how the test changes. In 2001, if you had an adoption plan in place, you passed. So that was counted as substantial conformance. In 2007, you had to have the adoption complete it within 2 years, not a plan in place. So it's just a different illustration. The second point I would make to you is that I think we are headed for some trouble here, some big trouble, and the trouble is financial. Oregon has adopted a adoptive assistance program, which I do not think is sustainable long term. And we have encouraged people to adopt by guaranteeing them a monthly stipend for the child. And although it's you know, I think I wish there were more discretion in it. Right now it is available for people who want to adopt. And there are some people who, without that stipend, could not adopt. And I would offer them, if I were in your seats, I would offer them the stipend. And there are other people who could afford to handle the expenses of a child and accept the stipend because it is available. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is something we're going to have to find ways to discourage.
So, yes, Senator Cruz.
So you're going to be proposing means testing? Or
Senator Cruz, it's one of the things that's on the agenda. If I propose means testing, there are those who will... We will be hearing from a variety of interest groups on these discussions, I'm sure.
I'm sure of that, yes. Yeah.
When I first, I had no idea that we were actually providing stipends for those who adopt. I assumed that if you adopt a child, that means you adopt the child. You don't get money for it. So I can understand the lower income, people who truly wanted to adopt but couldn't afford it. I can understand that, but... amazing.
Well,
I didn't know.
Special needs kids as well.
Special needs kids is a different issue, yeah.
Just something for discussion.
Right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the things that has made adoption assistance not sustainable financially in Oregon or in any other state, every state is struggling greatly with this, is since 1997 with the Adoption and Safe Families Act, we have dramatically increased the numbers of children that we're moving to adoption. Not only that, we're moving them at younger and younger ages, which means in 1980, when Public Law 96-272 was passed that created the Federal Adoption Assistance Program. Children were older. We had older children, and so they were on adoption assistance for less time. And in Oregon, I think in 1980, we had about 160 adoptions in a year. Now we're over 1,000. And they're younger and younger children. So it's really easy to see how that becomes cumulative. And even if we did continue to offer adoption assistance to every child, which we don't, not every child, it just is not financially sustainable. We see that same problem played out in item number 10, which is other planned permanent living arrangement, which is some gobbledygook, is some federal language for the child didn't get reunified and they didn't go to adoption and they didn't go to guardianship and relatives are not taking permanent care of these children. This is permanent foster care, by and large. And the reason that many people end up opting for permanent foster care is because when children move to adoption, the amount of the subsidy will be less money. And these are very difficult children. So the potential adoptive families say that they're unable to adopt the child with the type of subsidy that we offer. So that's the opposite side of the coin. Moving on to permanency outcome two, the continuity of family relationships and connections is preserved. Where we did the best is in of the entire review was how close we place children in foster care to their parents or to their families. And that, at least in theory, promotes frequent visitation with the parents and a continuing connection. We also did very well placing children with their siblings, exceeded the national bar for that. Visiting with parents and siblings in foster care, slightly less, and that means when a child's in foster care with the other children who are in foster care but not placed with that child and with the parents, did we have frequent enough visits? And a frequent enough visit has to exceed once a week in order to qualify as a strength for this.
Question on this one. I actually provide rental for at-risk families in my duplex. And in a case like this where there was actual sexual abuse of the brother with the sister and the parents were drug involved, and so that was an entirely different issue, that wouldn't count against you, would it?
Madam Chair, no. In the qualitative reading of the cases, that would, if that's documented that those siblings should not have contact with each other, that wouldn't be something that would count against us. Moving on, proximity, preserving connections. The importance here is to preserve connections between the child and their former school, with their community, with their tribe, with their friends, with their church. And we did fairly well, almost met the national standard on that. And relative placements, where we fall down in relative placements, we actually exceed. We're the leader across the country in the percentage of children who are adopted by their relatives, but where we fall down is in making the initial placement with relatives once we become aware of the child. I want to interrupt myself just for a second and say that we also have disparate outcomes that are not reflected in this report but have been the subject of many discussions that we've had with the regional office, and that's disparate outcomes along racial and ethnic lines, that children, African-American children and Native American children are greatly overrepresented in every phase of Oregon's child welfare system, and that is not unlike most other states. So when we look at a program improvement plan, we have to look at measures that address those differences and aim at reducing that disproportionality.
Let me talk about that a little bit, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
I really want to talk about that a little bit because I don't think enough cultural consideration is taken, and I have fussed with you guys' department for 24 years on this one, and that's a long time. In African-American society, you know, we believe in spanking. And I had a case with a young woman out in Hillsboro where her sister was involved in drug activity. She took the child, and she spanked him, and he called child welfare. And you guys came out. You gave her, I mean, you really chastised her. She had to go to court, and she almost lost her job. And she was trying to do the state and her sister a favor by taking her child. And I would be the first, when a child is bruised or something of that nature, to say something. But kids nowadays know that they can call you guys.
And so any kind of discipline you try to put upon them, then they call you guys. I'm going to tell you this. My little granddaughter pulled that on me, and I said, you call them, and they can put me in jail, and when I leave jail, I'm going to still spank your butt when I get back. Somewhere along the line, some consideration regarding cultural values and norms should be taken into consideration. Because I'm telling you, my mother wasn't one of those people who abused me, but she certainly believed in spanking my butt if I went contrary to the core values of what our family believed. And I'm not abused, and I'm not angry because she spanked my butt. And somewhere along the line, consideration need to be taken. This young woman is deeply hurt even until this day, and this has happened 2 years ago. And the kid is back in the home because he wanted to go back to that home. But he just didn't want to stand the test of being disciplined about something around school, his school subject, because she believes so strong. All of her kids have graduated from high school. Two of them have gone on to college. And had this little nephew want to come in and be... I'm concerned about that piece. Would you take a look at that one?
Certainly, Senator Carter. We not only intend to do that. That definitely is written into every single one of our goals that we've set out for our program improvement plan. Right. Is taking a look at why our children of color, specifically African American, Native American, overrepresented in every phase.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter. Not only are you right. Let me add another dimension to it. We don't provide sufficient services. We are statistically it demonstrates we are too quick on the draw in Native American and African American communities.
Right.
Largely, I think, not exclusively, but,
right.
but largely because we're not adequately culturally competent.
Right, and that's the piece that I'm concerned about, because I get so many more calls on this issue and contract compliance, which is not yours. That I've been fighting for 24 years. And if you'll remember, in 1995, I think it was, I raised you guys adoption people to number 18 mm-hmm. and gave you guys more people for adoption specifically for this issue in my committee. And somewhere along the line, we're not getting there. And I wish...
In addition, Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I contacted the Casey Foundation and requested a peer-to-peer, state-to-state. Texas has a much better record than we do, and Texas is sending out a peer team to work with us in the upcoming months on this very subject.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Carter.
I really appreciate Senator Carter raising the issue again. I remember last session, out of concern around the foster care issue, going back in the record and finding testimony that Senator Carter had provided to a committee in the 80s where she was raising the same concerns that she just raised a few moments ago on the record. And so it's remarkable to me that we're still talking about the same thing some 20-some years later. And you know, one has to ask the question, at what point do we listen to experience and wisdom and guidance from someone with the credibility of Senator Carter in this body? One just has to ask that question. Why don't we listen to those who can guide us to where we need to go?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I certainly hope that you will be part of that conversation with us. Please.
I'm willing to
please.
Do that. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Item 16 is the last one under permanency outcome 2. It has to do with the relationship of the child who is in care with parents. That measures how frequently do we involve the parent of a child who is in foster care in important events like medical appointments, school conferences, to make sure that the parent knows qualitatively how the child is doing and is able to participate and provide information during those appointments or during those events. and big margin for improvement there. And that, again, has been a resource issue for us, that if a caseworker has to choose to go out and investigate or to go and pick up a parent and bring them in for a school visit, that's the choice that they've had to make. Well-being, outcome one, this is probably our area overall where we have the greatest need for improvement, that at the end of the day, the families that we are serving, many of them do not end up with an enhanced capacity to care for their own children, and that has to do with the services that they need and then matching those services out in the community across a whole broad spectrum of things. I think we listed well over 30 services that our families routinely need, everything from housing and clothing and food stamps and medical assistance, substance abuse.
And members of the committee, this is items 19 and 20 were the two items where I discussed that the workers are likely to prioritize which kids need more visits as opposed to others.
Right. So as you can see, we were weak across well-being outcome one. Well-being outcome two looks at four different domains, actually. The first one are educational needs of the child. We really anticipate that we'll be doing much better because of the legislation that passed in 2007 that had to do with educational records of the children in our care. Item 22 has to do with the physical health, and item 23 has to do with the mental health. Physical health, really, we did very well, and that's getting kids in for an initial physical in a timely way once they come to our attention, and then following up at intervals with the recommended treatments. And then where we fell down, why we didn't meet the mark there, was on dental care. Dental care not being available across the state for children in foster care. And then last of all, our mental health services. And Mr. Johnston, I've already discussed that somewhat, so areas that we need to improve. The last two pages we're not going to go through unless you really want to. These are the supportive systems that we have to support the work that we do. The meat of the issues are in the outcomes and in the 23 line items that have to do with them. As you can see, that where we have weaknesses, for example, in foster care recruitment, that then becomes reflected in the outcomes or in the items. So systemically.
Question regarding if Ways and Means is able to come up with $3.5 million the system to better it, how do you see the money being used?
Madam Chair, if it is $3.5 million in addition to the money in the rebalance, then I would see it being used for the social services assistance. If it is $3.5 million, period, I'd have to argue that I'm going to use it to retain the caseworkers that we will otherwise have to cut.
Okay, thank you,
Madam Chair, and I have talked with the co-chairs on that, and the plan was that if the forecast had even maintained itself, if we had, you know, had not gone down but maintained itself, let alone go up, we could have done that. And I'm sure now we're going to be scrambling mm-hmm. for prioritizing what we do at this point, but I will certainly be in there fighting that we could maintain the dollars that are already in our system to be able to do what we need to do. And, Madam Chair, if there's anything I can say, and especially to our friends in the media, and that is that we have been on a long journey since 2003, when we were basically in the tank, at the bottom of the tank, in our resources. The legislature did a lot of cutting. I don't want to offer excuses for the department, nor do I want to offer excuses for the legislature, even though those of us who believe strongly in human services fought a good fight. We just didn't have the resources there to win. But this is a partnership. Saving our children has everything to do with every Oregonian in this state.
and with every member of this legislature. We just cannot say that we've hired you, and we've hired you, and we hired these other people. It has to be a system of care that all of us, our religious institutions have to step up to the plate. If we're going to save our children, we must look at this as a holistic approach to saving a society, because all of these are our children. And that's why I work so hard to try to get more African Americans to step up to the plate as foster parents, as adopted parents and that kind of stuff as well. But this is a job that is not going to be resolved overnight. And it's going to be easy to point a finger at you guys, but I have to remember that every time I point a finger at you, there's one pointing back at me, which is my little thumb. And so we have to work on this, and we cannot be inflammatory. We want to hold you accountable, and I think we have to do that. We have to hold you accountable. But we can't beat you down so much that you can't get your job done, and that every time you take 2 hours over, people don't recognize the fact that you're working overtime to try to ameliorate the issues and the unsafety practices that are going on with our children. So it's something that all of us must take to heart in working to greater solutions. But the department have to be more open at the ground level for correction. You guys might have it up here at the policy level all you want. But as when casework is not open, I think Senator Gordley, remember when we went to Pastor Hardy, to one of the members of the community, this man and his wife were in tears. And the caseworker was so nasty, she didn't even regard me, a legislator. So that's why I'm talking about groundwork, field work. There must be more understanding at that level. I even identified myself as Senator Carter. Pastor Hardy is somebody who's working very hard in this community. And the caseworker, it was as if Pastor Hardy wasn't Pastor Hardy, and if I wasn't Senator Carter. Somewhere along the line, they need to get the message. Because you guys have it at the top, but somewhere along the line, the field is not getting the message.
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Two pieces. If you could address training and item number
on page 19.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Item number 33. And just give us your take. You've made several references to training, but could you just capture what you think that means at this point in time for the agency, and what we need to do, and in what order?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, one of the things that I've been surprised at to discover coming back is the poverty of the training.
Mm-hmm.
I have three different pieces of the division of CAF, of self-sufficiency, OVRS, and child welfare. And child welfare workers, after they've done their initial training, which is a month long and is substantial, but after they've done their initial training, the net impact of training over the lifetime of their employment is going to be less than 1% of their hours.
Mm-hmm.
Less than 1%. Self-sufficiency is better. It's at 3%. Neither one of those is at the level that an organization needs if it wants to call itself a learning, growing organization.
Mm-hmm. And then lastly, how would you, I'm really reflecting on Senator Carter's comments, which were stated so well, how would you characterize the morale of staff currently, and how do you know?
One of the things I preface my remarks, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I preface my remarks this morning by saying I hope you won't take anything I say here as defensive. I've been arguing against this failing metaphor. You failed the state. You're failing the children, because our workers aren't failing. Mm-hmm. Our workers, by and large, and I admit Senator Carter told an anecdote about one. There are any number of folks who could use a little lesson in the concept of humble strength. But our workers, by and large, are doing a great job, and they do not deserve to be thrown under the bus.
That's right.
The system isn't measuring up, and that's where we fall down. The morale in the department, I would say, is fragile but good.
Mm-hmm.
Fragile in that they feel under attack. They feel some of the stories are direct reflections on them. But at the other hand, they know what work they're doing. These are folks who have chosen a line of endeavor that they want to do because they know what work they do is important. You know. Senator Hatfield once said that the most important choice you can make in life is the choice to be of service. These people are of service. So in that respect, they remain positive and they remain focused on the good work they're doing for us.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
We need to adjourn, or we're going to recess. We're not going to adjourn. But would you want time to give us the plan that you have to address these issues? No? Are you there yet?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are at work. We've had a program improvement plan committee that met immediately after the visit, and that met again this Monday, and we're in the draft draft portion of it. It's going to move quickly. I don't know that there would be much that could that we could present to you that would be in a sufficiently final form as to be particularly helpful.
I'd like to have this done then during the interim. Do you think, what's the time frame, do you think?
It has to be in the federal government's hand by April 7th.
Okay, so after April 7th, coming back to us to let us know exactly how you're going to be addressing each of these in our interim, so if you could put that. All right, and then on Wednesday, we will be covering psychiatric medications in the foster care. I'm not sure you need to be here, but I know that their staff from your agency are going to be addressing that issue for Wednesday.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Madam Chair, let me say one other thing. I went over this issue was taken so seriously that the governor addressed workers from around the region. Senator Vicky Walker and I went over to be a part of that, to say to them, there's a problem, but we're in this together, and we are going to hold you accountable for resolution to this problem. So I just want to say that with Dr. Goldberg and with Mr. Johnston, that they are taking all of these federal, you know, initiatives very seriously in our state. And if there's anything I can say, and that is that I have been working closely with them to be a part of changes that we're making and solutions to the problems that we have. And so they have not, they immediately called people into meetings to see how they're going to ameliorate some of the issues that are around these
issues. All right. We're going to be recessing until 5:05. I know some of you may be in other committees, but we're told that the amendments will be to Senate Bill 1100 will be ready this afternoon, and so I will now recess until 5:05. We will be I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 1075. Colleagues, we had the dash twos, and there was a request that we add two more employee reps to that task force. And so that is before you, and I'd like to entertain a motion for the dash two amendments.
Madam Chair, I move adoption of the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1075.
Senator Gourley moves that we add the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1075. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Well, clerk, call the roll. Well, no, I still have to redo the whole bill. I mean,
you want to adopt the amendment first.
So there's no opposition to the amendments? Okay, so ordered. All right. I now would entertain.
Madam Chair, I move
adoption of Senate Bill 1075 as amended, and that the with a due pass recommendation, and that the Ways and Means referral be rescinded.
Okay. Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 1075 as amended with a due pass recommendation to with a request to the President's office to rescind the referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Excused.
Senator Morsett?
Excused.
Vice Chair Gordley?
Aye.
And Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye. Motion passed. And if it comes to the floor, you wanted Jeff Cruz to... Okay. That'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1075. I'd open a work session on Senate Bill 1100, and we have colleagues... the dash twos, the dash threes, and the dash fours. So, Senator Atkinson, would you please come forward? And I'd like to make this very quick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator, Southern Oregon. Thank you very much for the deference this morning, and very big thanks to Legislative Council. They were absolutely terrific. Three of us went down right after the meeting that you saw us this morning, and we did three things. Number one, there was the conformity language that DHS had about conform and rules. We decided it'd be easier rather than changing one word just to delete a sentence. As an old editor told me, it's always better to make it shorter than longer, and so we deleted the sentence. That's what the dash two is. The dash three is a way we had a conversation, how do we eliminate the fiscal? That is certainly, given what we're up against, the most important thing. So we kicked it around for some time, and I wish Jim were here from DHS, but what was, he said if we just limited this to mental health only, and the services that's being done in mental health, just so that telehealth can get a foothold in Oregon, we can come back in 09 and certainly see if it's able to be expanded to other forms of clinical care. But what the dash threes do is limit it to mental health only. By doing so, he believes, and I don't have a letter in front of me, but he believes that the fiscal will be eliminated. The dash four amendments, the third amendment, is just to keep my word to you that I said I'd get a pilot program. And the pilot program then is limited to four counties, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, which are significantly hit by the ONC issues that we have. I recognize that it could be an administrative difficulty, Chair, but at the same time, I wanted to keep my word to you, so that's why there's three. The ones I strongly advocate certainly are the first one, the Dash 2 Amendment, which is the simplification between DHS and DCBS, and then the second one, which will eliminate the fiscal, which is limiting it just to mental health.
Okay. Colleagues, I can give you my read on these, and I did talk to Jim Edge. I called him as soon as I had gotten a hold of these. He was getting ready to go in an appointment, medical appointment. I think he said, I can't remember what, but he is unable to be here. And I read them to him, and he said yes. So you'll see in the Section 4, 1, the DHS may adopt rules, which is permissive, and then the B part, the director shall adopt rules for mental health. So that's it. So the dash 3s and the dash 4s are okay. I would not like to have the dash 2s and the dash 3s, but I cannot accept the dash 4s. It would be an administrative nightmare, and we still have a lot of work to work with the insurers regarding telemedicine. So that's my preference.
Chair Anderson, that's delightful. I think the important thing here is the fact that, especially on the mental health, that's what is my biggest pushing concern, And if we can get set up, essentially, if we can extend the service and go right now to the point of having the service get created not only in rural Oregon but in the counties that significantly need it, that's the most important. I also followed up, as I told you this morning, with USDA about their ability to put grants for technology if rural clinics or county mental health services or whatever need it. And the answer is yes. So we have a real opportunity to do something good, and for that I'm very thankful for the extra 8 hours.
Great. And I think, colleagues, it still has to go to Ways and Means. We don't know yet. We haven't had PEB enter in, and that was just brought to my attention. They are considered private insurer, but they're really taking money from us and the general fund to pay for that. So that's my preference. So I would entertain motions.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
So, Senator, in Section 4, Subsection 1 and Subsection 8, the Director of Human Services may, by rule, may adopt rates and requirements for reimbursing health professionals for telemedical physical health services provided to recipients of state medical assistance. Now, which one is, because this refers, still referring to physical health.
And that says may, but if you go to the next paragraph, B, it shall adopt for mental health.
Okay.
So shall is and may.
So that's the distinction you were making a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what we found is, I mean, the for me, the driver here is mental health services.
Right.
Certainly, telehealth, as it was brought to my attention just a moment ago from Representative Maurer, has been going fantastic with the VA system. When we wrote this originally, we had two things in particular to be mindful. One is Medicare and Medicaid rules, both of those. By limiting it down, I think if there's going to be opposition to the bill, I think that opposition can either be overcome or we can breathe until 09. My biggest worry is that if my ONC funding doesn't come through, that we've got people who are going to be at least potentially for a year without an option. And that's what I don't want to have the counties overwhelmed if that funding doesn't come through when it comes to mental health, because then what they're going to, those counties would do naturally is say, okay, Salem, you handle it. And as we all know, Salem's not ready to handle it.
That's right.
Yes, Chair. Senator Atkinson, if you could, just for the record, identify the three people that you said you all went down to LC and worked this out, just so we have that for the record.
Why don't you come up and introduce yourself and add any, and Jim?
Edge. Thank you.
Jim Edge, and my new favorite colleague.
For the record, Dr. Gina Nickel, Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and we represent all 36 counties.
I learned from you.
Thank you so much.
So it was Jim Edge,
myself,
Gina Nickel, and you.
And a fantastic drafter.
And so, Madam Chair, are you ready
yes.
for a motion to move?
Yes.
I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill.
Senator Gorley moves
1100.
The -2 amendments to Senate Bill 1100. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, move the -3 amendments to Senate
Senator
Bill.
Senator Gorley moves the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 1100. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
And we're not moving the fours, or we are moving the fours. We're not moving the fours, okay. I'm looking at those counties. I have those counties on my mind, okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1100 as amended to, with the DuPass recommendation, to the full Ways and Means Committee.
Senator Gorley moves Senate Bill 1100 as amended with a DuPass to the full Ways and Means. Any discussion?
I would just like to say for the record to Dr. Gina Nickel, who's here, and also to the other significant Nickel in the back of the room, thank you 1,000 times for your work over the past 24, 48 hours. And actually, just thank you 1,000 times for the work that you that you do every day to help us keep the mental health system that we have together, but also to help advance the work. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Here. Yeah.
Senator Cruz?
Excused.
Senator Morstad?
Excused.
Vice Chair Gordley?
Aye.
And Chair Monson?
Motion passes, and we are adjourned.